This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this episode is Kit Umbach. Kit, it's good to have you with me.
Glad to be here, Eric.
So the way the show begins is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities of life you aspire to live by, or the labels you wear? What do we need to know to start the conversation?
I think you mentioned about in the some of the prep we sent that we could take the perspective of stories.
Sure, absolutely.
What stories would we tell ourselves, or would we want to tell others about ourselves? And I think the story that I'd like to actually start with is one that of course is going to need some context, but it's a one sentence story. I committed to the spiritual practices of an established religion after confronting a life-threatening condition. And that, I think, has defined much of my life, that commitment. It doesn't really tell you much about who I am or what I do, but it does tell you about my orientation towards spirituality.
And towards a kind of loyalty to tradition.
That's right. That I'm working within the context of what I consider an established religion. Others may consider it more unconventional or newer on the scene. It's certainly an institution that supports a community, a worldwide community.
So do you want to unpack a little bit of that now, or do you want to, are there other sentences that.
There are other sentences that I came up with too, because I think that'll help give some more definition to my experience. The other sentence was that I majored as an undergraduate in college in physics and philosophy, and I chose a career path in science and engineering. Mm-hmm. So that, I think, helps people then say, "Oh well, I do something. You know, I have a place in the world," and that I think is important too. And I had one more sentence that I thought I would these of course will be opportunities.
We will unpack them in various ways.
Right. So I lived in a Cornell freshman dormitory as a faculty in residence for 5.5 years until 2019.
Wow.
So that experience had impact on my life, and the reasons I chose it reflect some of my orientation and my interests. So that was, I think that was the third sentence that I came up with that perhaps is a story that someone might say about me that I think would be helpful.
Sure. Sure. And that was the last of the sentences?
Well, yes, I also identified general themes to my life, but I think those might be beyond what we want to do right now. So those are good stories to start.
Yeah. The way we will proceed is you will weave those things into the questions that I will ask that will come somewhat oblique to the sentences that you've given us, but they'll get us there. Also, I've had many people come to me with lists of words, either nouns or verbs, or things that describe them, but I've never had anyone come to the show with sentences. That's a neat kind of response, these kind of sentences that frame a dimension of your life and how you live it. That's beautiful. So you also brought music with you. What should we open the show with? What should we play now at the beginning?
Well, I picked a piece from Bach, a keyboard piece. And I think we should start there. Mm-hmm. I can certainly give you some background on why we would start there.
Well, do so. If you before we play it, so we have a sense of what you're asking us to listen.
Right. my mother, who actually she passed 2 months ago, was a musician, a music major, and although she was kind of a banjo picking outdoors woman from Boise, Idaho, she loved Bach, and I grew up in a household where that kind of music was valued. And my parents, sort of in their middle years, built a harpsichord. And so this association with Bach and the harpsichord really ties into sort of my beginnings.
Sure.
And so that's why I chose.
That's beautiful. Here we go. This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this episode is Kit Umbach. So Kit, you've given us three sentences that get pieces of your life. Now I'm going to ask a question What were some of the experiences that you had to go through that you learned from, you either had to or you chose to, that you learned how something about how to live the life you value, something about the life you value and how to live it? What experiences invited you into that awareness, and what have you learned about life and how to live it?
Well, I think the my first sentence was an experience that of confronting mortality as a 19-year-old, not that there weren't there were certainly options and hope it offered, but when you're 19, you don't you're not the top of your list of things that you think you might be dealing with is not a life-threatening disease. Right. So that experience, I think, shifted my perspective on how one thinks about the value of one's life. It certainly gave me pause about my... how I lived my life up to then, so it shaped me in several ways, because it kind of opened me up. It also made me deal with fear and anxiety in a deep way that I had not yet done, as I said, it led me to a spiritual path that I think has been nurturing and progressive for me, so that's like any experience, it has multiple dimensions.
Right. What can you say more about what the experience was, what the threat was?
Yeah. We don't have to go into the details of all the medical diagnosis, but essentially, I had a malignant tumor in a part of my body that that raised a lot of concern about spreading, I began a course of treatment, but in the course of that treatment, I was staying. I had to leave the town I was living in. I went to live with a relative closer to the medical care, but that relative happened to be a Christian Scientist, and I don't know. How much I should go into the religion of Christian, the religion of Christian Science.
I think it's what did you interact with? What did you take away from that experience?
Yeah. Well, Christian Science is a religion that emphasizes the power of prayer for healing. And so this family that I was living with, this is my aunt actually, and she was very supportive, of my getting the medical care, but at the same time, she taught me about Christian Science, and I was very attentive because, when there were all sorts of things stirring in my thought, and I really absorbed those lessons, and I don't know if you could call it a conversion experience, but I certainly felt that there was a new path for me to follow. Mm-hmm. And I reached a point where I had to make a choice about whether I would continue radiation therapy I went through radiation therapy, and then the choice was, well, now are you going to do chemotherapy? And at that point, I decided that I was not going to, that I was going to rely on Christian Science for my physical care, mm-hmm. and that's what I did, mm-hmm. That was, of course, a challenging time for me and my family, because they were trying to figure out, what was going on with me and my path there. And to their credit, they were very supportive. They really mm-hmm. respected my choices. And for me, that made the path easier, certainly. So at the same time of confronting mortality, there was a discovery of, what I might call the life of the spirit, right? Which I had not lived before.
Right. And, you know, one of the hats that I wore in the past was as a cancer chaplain. And so you didn't have to, as you learned from your aunt, you didn't have to choose between Christian Science and conventional science. But at some point it became clear that having had the radiation therapy, you didn't want to go on with chemotherapy.
That's right. That's right.
And people, those are sort of choices that are based in terms of reason, that are based on percentages and likely outcomes in terms of reason. On the medical side. But on the spiritual side, there's a whole different way of holding yourself and holding your what you value. So how did you process that choice? How did you come to that?
Hey, I really appreciate you noting that, because I think that noting the fact that it's not just a calculation of probabilities when you're making that kind of decision in the context.
No, it's not. How you're going to live. It's how you're going to die.
That's right.
Too.
Right. And so what I had at that time was a conviction that I was healed, that I did not need to go any further. And that conviction was not just based on the material sort of picture, you know, the medical situation, but also on my inner sort of spiritual sense and of a healing. And
something had changed in you that was made it unlike what you had been when you had active cancer.
Yeah, I think that there was a sense of freedom, a sense mm-hmm. of being loved, a sense of not needing to worry anymore about this problem. And
right.
And I think that's what healing is a freeing and you know, in Christian Science we view that as a real change of thought, that is
right.
that it's associated with the physical transformation. There's a change of thought, and that was what I was experiencing.
Right, and I want to flip it back in a way that may relate to people who don't necessarily have experience in healing prayer or spiritual healing. There comes a point, even and for people who have no sense of religion or spirituality, where their sense of things being complete or whole or done, they just arrive there. And you know, the probabilities may say that, well, it would be good if you did chemo, you know, because there's this probability and it reduces that by this amount. But they're just kind of done with it, because for whatever reason, they feel complete. They've done what they needed to do. And I hear that kind of clarity and resolve in your story too.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, I wasn't afraid.
Yeah.
I was not afraid to move ahead in this way. And that was such a wonderful relief, a sense of the presence of good.
Yeah. And it also means that you were an active driver of your own healthcare. Because when you came to that awareness, you could then act on it, and you had a sense of power to do that. That's really unusual at 19.
I think it is. Although, when I have to say that you know the opening of thought that occurs when you're really searching mm-hmm. is something that makes all sorts of possibilities accessible.
Right. When you are genuinely curious and not desperately needy, you can see a lot of opportunities and a lot of options, and you can do things that you never thought you could.
I agree and I think it's possible, you know, so maybe this is where we do a little weaving. Mm-hmm. But because I grew up very curious and mm-hmm. Very interested in just everything about how everything works and how things are put together. Mm-hmm. And so I think I was, you know, that kind of orientation is so helpful when you're opening yourself to something new. You want to be a good listener, a good observer. And mm-hmm. And I think that did help me.
Right. And it's been 40-ish years since that cancer?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So, you know, 43, if we want to be exact.
Yeah. No, I'm just,
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, and so, yeah, how, yeah, that's just neat. Let's cut to music and come back to some of these themes. Again, what should we play next?
Well, the I wanted to actually play the Schumann scenes from childhood, the Kinderszene, next, because I do think that the environment of my youth was one full that had music, and my sister, who was a musician and a writer, I remember her distinctly playing this piece on the piano, and I was not a gifted, you know, musician at all, but I loved listening to her play it, and it reminds me of that I think purity and simplicity of our youth. So that's why I value this piece.
I'm Eric Clay. This is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this episode is Kit Umbach. So, Kit, you talked about the gift of music as a child, the art, the curiosity you had, but you also talked about majoring in physics and philosophy, and kind of the big picture points of view of how things, what are the forces at play here, and how do they work together. And tell me more about your childhood. How free were you? You seemed to be able to have made a choice that maybe even went against your own parents' guts when you made that choice about care. So what helped make you the kind of person who would have that kind of freedom at 19?
Well, I think that, growing up, I was the kind of young person who loved to just be by themselves working on some puzzle or science project or reading a book. And so there was a kind of sort of introspective quality solitary aspect to my life. A pathological way, you know, but just that was just, I was very comfortable being alone. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed my family, and, you know, we were very active, you know, family, doing all sorts of trips and explorations and adventures. But I was comfortable being on my own, and very curious. And so my father encouraged that. He had been a physics major. And so, you know, I was a kind of kid who had a chemistry set in the basement and was blowing things up and just having fun, you know, seeing what you could do. And so I think that development of curiosity and also learning how to think, either through just experimentation and observation, mm-hmm. but also, you know, in school where where you're challenged by math problems or science problems. And that was always something that I loved to do.
Right, right. And did you say to be by yourself or to be alone? What was the word you used? Because I just lost.
Well, it. I think I said solitary.
Solitary. But, okay. So right. Yeah. Because yeah. And when you spoke of it in that way, it implies kind of a solitude and a comfort in your own skin.
Yeah, I mean, I think the distinction I would make. I think I agree with you. Is that I think I was I had a comfort in my own mind. Mm-hmm. And I think I was comfortable with my thoughts,
right?
And comfortable being alone with my thoughts.
Right.
But I think also, you know, this is something I think that's been a lifelong project was, you know, how do you kind of reconcile or resolve things that you know and can control, mm-hmm. and things that you can't know intellectually, things
right.
that are transcendent beyond our sort of our human minds. And
right.
I think that has been that's kind of an intellectual description of that tension, you might call it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, so my experience at 19 was really introducing me to ways to learn about the life of the spirit, which I really hadn't been very aware of.
Right, right. And it introduced you to the life of the spirit when something had gone terribly funky with your body.
Yes.
And the reason that I said comfortable in your skin was that you talked about being out in nature, and as well as doing experiments in the basement, blowing things up where you might get hurt. You didn't seem to be too preoccupied or self-conscious about your physical safety. And the curiosity often takes us into places where other things happen. And so it seemed to me more than in your head. And
no, I would agree with that. And and I did and I do love nature.
Right.
And that was cultivated in my family. Mm-hmm. As I said, my mother was from Idaho, and so we would every summer we would travel from the Midwest, north of Chicago, where I lived, and we would travel to a small town on a lake in central Idaho, and we would be just set free to explore, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we would be fishing, we would be taking little jaunts up streams, we would be walking in the woods, so I think that also again gave me a sense of comfort in just being in nature, because the more time you spend there, the more alert you become to it, and more secure in being in it. And
the more you know its sensorial delights,
and you
know when your body feels right and when your body doesn't feel right, especially when you're in an unfamiliar place in nature and you're using all of your physical senses to kind of engage.
Yeah, I think when you're young, you're very susceptible in a good way, because to the sights and sounds and mm-hmm. smells of nature,
mm-hmm.
because you're not necessarily kind of analyzing them. You're just absorbing them.
As well as the rumblings of your tummy and the belching and all the other functions that go on inside.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so I did appreciate very much those experiences in nature. And I still do.
Yeah. Your mind met your spirit in the crucible of your body not working right.
I think you're coming up with one sentence to describe it. I think that's great. That's a good one sentence description.
So what did you discover about yourself and about spirituality that you did not know before?
Well, I think what I discovered was that, and I, it, it, you know, it's, when you embark on this kind of path, you don't get it all at once, right?
No. It's an unfolding.
You're really just getting a glimpse, but you have a conviction that there's something there that you didn't realize was there before. And in this case, it was a larger sense of identity, a larger sense of being, just to use, if you have to use a word, describe it, that being includes me and others and the universe. Yeah. And this being is something that we're just integrally connected to, that we can't be separated from.
Right. And something that you participate in, but cannot control or even imagine its immensity.
That's right. I mean, certainly, you know, in physics, I was learning about, you know, the concept of infinity, and, you know, we would always talk about limits of certain laws to infinity. But when you think about infinity in a spiritual sense, it is, you know, that it's just the vastness of existence that we're part of, you know, right. And when you think of, or, you know, you can think of infinity as an intellectual construct, but when you think that we're part of this, this infinite ongoing unfoldment, that's a revelation.
And the foundation of my spiritual life was in part set at the age of 20 when I realized infinity is merely anything which exceeds my comprehension or my grasp.
Yeah.
And anything. And that kind of humbling was just incredibly powerful for me.
Using that word humbling, I think, is good, because it's often when we're struggling with a problem, we sometimes think that we've got to willfully solve it, or we've got, right, it's our responsibility. And again, in this situation that I was in, I couldn't fix this problem. I could not do it myself.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And you could accept that. You came to accept that.
I came to accept that, and I think also that's another.
Celebrate it.
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's a great, you know, the joy of finding a new path is of course it's hard to describe it, but you feel renewed. You feel that you're, you know, there's some trepidation. You know, there's obviously this transition is not one that's you have to make overnight, but there's a sense of that there's something really new and valuable that you want to pursue. And I agree that, you know, there was a shift away from thinking that intellectual pursuit was actually the only path to understanding. Right. And understanding in a broad way, you know, and feeling connected, right?
Right.
Seeing one's place.
So the way you describe your implicit definition, I'm going to say this, of spirituality is seeing one's place and being in this larger environment. And as a professor, you're also teaching very practical, material-based activities, but they work in two different kinds of realms.
You've touched on the essential tension here.
Yep.
I mean, I think that this is perhaps the, you know, I mean, it's a tension, I think, that we all, I mean, you could call it the mind-body duality. You know, there's all sorts of names you could give to this, which is that in my case, I have real curiosity about the world, and that's expressed itself in learning more about aspects of physical and chemical functioning of materials, because I'm in the Department of Material Science, Cornell, right? And so I am genuinely curious about those, and I think there's a lot of utility for both to society and also to education to share these insights. But at the same time, I'm also committed to a deeper sort of concept of understanding.
Right. And they are both immensely practical.
they are.
And that's what I'm impressed by, because it's not the theology, philosophy off in the distance. It's the practice of the spirituality.
Yes, I agree with that. Maybe that's the engineer in me that whatever I'm going to be engaged in, I have to see the connection to my life in a practical way.
Cool. Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Well, we were talking about nature, and as I said, I find great satisfaction in being in nature. So I chose a piece by Schubert, who is one of my favorite composers, the Trout Quintet. My father taught me how to fly fish and how to enjoy the outdoors. This piece, I think more than any other piece I know, evokes that the splashing of the trout and the gurgling of the stream and the breeze wafting. And so it's just a great romantic, piece of how can we translate nature into music.
Yeah. You're a fly fisherman to the heart.
I am.
Thank you.
This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm Eric Clay, your host, and our guest on this episode is Kit Umbach. So Kit, the question I like to go to next is, how has life in some ways worked out in a way that you wouldn't have expected, that maybe you would never have chosen, but it's proven really important to you?
Well, yes, I think, you know, I've described this spiritual path that I stepped on, but I think that it took many years for that path to work itself out in a way that it was consistent with my career and my kind of calling and I ended up really not following a conventional path of a scientist engineer, in the sense that I didn't, you know, get a tenured faculty position at a university and start doing research and collecting graduate students and doing that. Just as things developed, you know, I got married, I stayed in Ithaca, and what evolved was. And I can only see this now, sort of in retrospect. I didn't realize it at the time, and I think at the time it seemed frustrating that I wasn't able to kind of go in the direction that I thought that this was the conventional path, and so there was some frustration, and I think some self-doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But what I eventually realized was that I needed to have more service, a sense of service in what I did. And that's what happened was I ended up actually helping run facilities which were not focused on my research, but rather were helping people do their research.
Right.
And I ended up doing more teaching, which I had not really conceived of as, I sort of viewed teaching as a kind of secondary aspect of being a faculty member. But I did more teaching, and I started connecting to students more, and then those connections, I realized that I actually had a kind of a good temperament and sensibility for helping students kind of find their paths, you know, in a narrow sense, you know, in engineering and talking to them and advising. And that's what led me to become a faculty in residence at Cornell, was to just be able to connect more with students and with mm-hmm. the student experience. So I didn't, you know, that was not a path I would have predicted for myself,
right?
But it was one that evolved.
Yeah, and it's very much the way you describe your parents is they created the environment, the facilities in which you could then be curious.
Well, yeah, I mean, it helped me having a curiosity about the world can, under some circumstances, expand into a curiosity about people.
It also can be is you understood the container in which curiosity can happen somewhat safely. And for a lot of people in college, they do not understand how to have a curiosity, have their container within a curiosity that's productive.
I see what you're saying. Yes, I agree with that. That because I was curious about so many things, it did help me connect with students with different backgrounds and different perspectives, and to help them, you know, maybe as you said, begin to shape their curiosity or their interests in a way that could become a college experience.
Right. And people from my, and this is my bias coming through here, people don't just need, especially at college, they don't need people that they can debate ideas. They need persons they can grow against, whose wholeness they can meet their wholeness, even though it may be an intellectual topic or a material topic. It's the whole person that's coming at you with all of their energy and doubt and enthusiasm and fear. that you have to meet.
Yeah, I think, you know, the idea of a faculty in residence is that here's somebody who has progressed along to a point of having a career in academics, but they're a real person. They have interests. They have, you know, we had our dog in the apartment. We lived right with the students. And the idea, I mean, I think it's absolutely true that, as you said, as they, in their encounters with me, they're able to recognize first that their faculty, all their instructors are people, and that there's a relationship there, and they could model that, right. And also that it gives them a sense of being in a community where mm-hmm. there are older people or more experienced people that are really genuinely interested in them,
right.
And this is it's very positive for the students.
And it's so different than the experience I generally had as a first semester freshman in 1976, which was just 7 years after the riots and the takeover. And it's like, there are no people here. I had grown up in a rural community where every person wanted to know more about the person, even if they were a visitor in town from far away or whatever, they just were curious, but there was no curiosity, you know? I said to myself, there are no people here because they treat you like a student, or they treat the faculty like professors, or nobody really inquires about each other's lives.
I love the way you say it's so ironic that in a university which values ideas and academics that we lose sight of the people who are living those ideas, yeah. And the people who are trying to learn those ideas. And I think that, you know, I'm good at this because I'm curious about people. And I think, how did I get here? Because I ended up being curious about atoms and electrons. And I think it was because of my spiritual path that enabled me then to start to make connections to people.
That's neat. Let's cut once again to music and then come to the last segment of the show. What should we play next?
Well, I picked a song, September Song, by Kurt Weill, sung by Lotta Lenya, who was actually Weill's wife. And it's a little bit of a melancholy song, sort of bittersweet, because it talks about how, you know, our relationships have a finite lifetime, and that we shouldn't dawdle. We should throw ourselves into that and embrace what we have. And the reason I chose that is that September is actually a very poignant month for me as well, and the song embodies that poignancy. I was married in September. One of my two children, my daughter, was born in September. My wife passed away in September, and my mother passed away in September.
And so, just this past September.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. My mother. And the song speaks for itself.
Yes. Here we go.
Oh, it's a long, long while from mid till December. The days grow short when you reach September, when the autumn weather turns the leaves to flame. One hasn't got time for the waiting game. Precious days. spend with you. When you meet with a young man early in spring, they court you in song and rhyme. They woo you with words and a clover ring. But if you examine the goods they bring, they have little to offer but the songs they sing and a plentiful waste of time of day and a plentiful waste of time. But it's a long, long while from May till December. The leaves to flame. For the days dwindle down to a precious few.
This is the Made of Clay Report. I'm your host, Eric Clay, and our guest on this episode is Kit Umbach. You may or may not want to go into any more detail of this. What did you learn about life in your wife's passing?
Well, I thought about this as I considered the interview, and I think that it's important that, you know, that those of us who are confronted with the passing of a loved one, that we share what we've learned in some way, because I think the worst thing for an individual who's grieving is to feel alone.
Right.
And because there is, I think, now much more awareness about the processing of grief. I think it's important that we open our arms to that experience of others. The teachings of Christianity were helpful to me. And I did think about that in this context. And you may know that Jesus Christ had there's a part of in the Gospels called the Sermon on the Mount, and where he's speaking to people, large crowds, and within the Sermon on the Mount there are these statements we call the Beatitudes, one of them is which I'll read if I could I'll just read it very shortly. How happy are those who know what sorrow means, for they will be given courage and comfort. And that's a translation from the New Testament by a guy named J.B. Phillips, which I really treasure. Mm-hmm. And I just want to point out, you know, that sort of the King James Version is, you know, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. But what I love about this is, first of all, you know, Phillips uses the word happy.
Right. And some other translations do as well. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, what's that saying is that there's a promise of moving through sorrow. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you avoid sorrow or that you skip over it, but you move through it, and there's a promise of comfort, and at the end you're happy. Now that happiness isn't, you know, I think, you know, this is obviously a topic that could go on forever, but that happiness, you know, that happiness is not just momentary passing sense of gleefulness. You know, it's really a deeper sense of joy and, yep, and permanent joy, not one that's interfered with by circumstance. And so I did find that the teaching of Christianity helpful in my experience. Mm-hmm. But what I've learned though, and I think it's important, everybody grieves differently. And my children grieve differently than I do. And I had to come to respect that. I have to say that the loss of the loved one, in this case, it pushed me to become more compassionate, both for myself and for others. And it gave me a deeper sense of what life means. So, mm-hmm, you know, that doesn't come overnight, but it certainly was something that I learned.
Right. There's just a handful of the 600 interviews that I've done where we've come to this kind of place at the end with the death of a loved one and learning how to snatch joy in the bowels of sorrow. And that is kind of a life arc discipline, because the last question of the show is, how do you take care of yourself? Mm. Well, in the face of the death of your beloved, you find sorrow and joy and love.
Are we going to that last question?
Yes, now, yes, we are. So we're going to spend just a few minutes on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say that in the sorrow, you deepen your sense of the value of the relationship, mm-hmm, and you really begin to recognize what is important in a relationship, and you learn from the loss to see what's important. And I think for me, that enabled me then to go on to another relationship. And so, you know, my wife passed in 2015, and in 2017, I started to become friends with a woman who now I consider my companion. And mm-hmm, we live in different cities, not too far away, but, you know, not so close that we can see each other frequently. Once or twice a week, which is really wonderful.
It's sweet.
But so when you talk about how to take care of yourself, you really need I think recognize that we all deserve to be loved, and we all deserve to be able to give love. And I think that's, you know, when we can genuinely practice that, you know, every day, like, you know, how do we, you know, so taking care of oneself, I think, means seeing that, when am I giving love and when am I receiving love? And if I'm not doing that, then you say, oh, well, maybe I should take a step back and figure out why that's not happening. And, that's one thing that I do. It's just do a little spiritual accounting and make sure that I'm really, grateful listening, because that's so important to moving through difficult situations.
Right. Kit, it's been really wonderful to get to know you.
This has been a great exercise for me, and I love the insights you shared about your own, you know, perspectives here. They're helpful to me.
What should we close the show with?
Well, in the spirit of new relationships and moving forward, I picked a very popular French song. So I think this is actually from the late 20s, early 30s, c'est si bon. It's so good. And I think it highlights the joy that we feel in the company of those we care about. And it has the wonderful sort of cheery background of the accordion, which is my favorite happy instrument.
C'est si bon de partir n'importe où, poids dessous, en chantant des chansons. C'est si bon de se dire des mots, des petits rien du tout, mais qui en disent long en voyant. Notre mine revue, les passants dans la rue nous envient. C'est si bon d'écouter dans ses yeux un espoir merveilleux qui donne la prison. C'est si bon. Petite sensation, et si nous nous aimons, c'est parce que c'est si bon.
C'est bon.